Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to the new voice of Conservative Talk Radio. Unafraid and aggressive, he will take on anyone, including Republicans. This is Aaron McCready. Give Aaron a call at 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. Also, follow him on Twitter at Aaron McCready and visit him on the web at aaronmccready.com.
Well, we are all set, ready to go. I'm here, Adam's here, man the phones. Give us a call, 646-200-3400, or you can go to our online chat, actually on blogtalkradio.com, and you can join the chat there. Today, we are talking about Syria, and to be honest, I am torn on the issue. On one hand, America is the moral authority of the world, and people from other countries look to us for guidance, or at least they used to. But you know what? How can we sit by knowing that innocent men, women, and children are dead by a gas attack? You know, yes, Syria may be in a civil war, and yes, we must let them take care of their own country in their own way. But also remember that during our first civil war, and what I mean by that is the war for independence, we had help from another country. We had help from France. But however, I also see it as another war that America may be entering. Yes, I support and still do the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the difference that I see between those and this war is that those wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, we had a set objective and goals. Other than teaching Assad and Syria a lesson, what is the goal? I am not sure if I want to see our men and women in uniform subjected to the horrible use of sarin gas like we saw on TV that CNN showed. Also, are we going to be alone in this? And if we face repercussions, are we going to face repercussions from Iran and possibly Russia? Right now, I don't have the answers for you, but this hour, we're going to figure it out together. And now joining me from our nation's capital is a great friend of the show, Jack Caravelli. As you know, Jack worked extensively for the CIA and also for both the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Currently, he is director of a fantastic site, Lignet.com, that's Lignet.com. It focuses on global intelligence and forecasting, and if you really want to get an insider's knowledge of not only domestic events, but events globally, you'll check out Lignet.com. Jack, as always, welcome to the show.
Aaron, thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and certainly your audience as well.
Well, I appreciate that. We've got a lot to talk about, but I do want to talk about Syria. But before we get into that, first, since we're approaching 9/11, and we're not going to have a show tomorrow due to the presidential address at 9 o'clock, and then we're not having a show on 9/11 because it is 9/11, but I'd like to send my sympathies and gratitude to all the family and friends that suffered losses on both September 11th, 2001, and also September 11th, 2012, in the Benghazi attacks. And, Jack, you knew the ambassador who was assassinated, Christopher Stevens. And my question for you, and hopefully you can help me out with this because I still cannot find an answer, why don't we really know any more than we did that night? And why can't the Obama administration tell us exactly what they know?
Well, Aaron, first, thanks. I agree and share a lot of your frustration and certainly anger. As you said, I did know the ambassador, tremendous man who just represented all of us with enormous intelligence, enthusiasm, and distinction. And, you know, we have lost, of course, not only a great public servant, but, you know, the three men that were trying to protect him as well, who also served the nation valiantly. It's a terrible loss, and I think it is a black mark on this administration that we don't have more answers to the kind of issues I think you have in mind when you ask me your question. I think we probably know more than has been revealed publicly. I think the administration does have some insights into at least some of the people involved in the attack that night. They have, to my knowledge, done little, if anything, in any way to bring them to justice. And that, again, is a scourge that is just appalling, and I think, sadly, is too representative of the weakness of this White House, and it's certainly carrying over into the Syria problem as well.
You know, since you brought up Syria, and of course that's what we're talking about, you know, you've worked for some administrations before. What, in regards to Syria, if you could give us somewhat of a behind-the-scenes look, what is the administration discussing or, you know, from your opinion, speculation, what would they be discussing right now on the verge of possibly a war with Syria?
Well, I think there's a couple of sort of key areas that we can hone in a little bit. First, let me preface it by saying that, you know, the situation we're in today and the president will talk about tomorrow night is simply, in my mind, a reflection of what you just said, really bad or almost non-existent policy in the region. I call it Obama not having a North Star, a compass that sort of guides the actions, or a philosophy, a strategy that in very difficult circumstances, you know, helps get you through. And the administration, I think, gets very low marks for having any plan of attack in any sense, if you will. But let me try to be a little more specific to your question. You know, the first is the politics. You know, obviously they're trying to figure out what's going to happen domestically in Congress, but, you know, within the confines of certainly the National Security Council, the foreign policy staff, you know, they will be looking with the military, of course, at, you know, if there is to be an attack, you know, the nature of the attack, the number of targets, how many weapons do we want to use, what ships will launch those weapons, all of the operational planning that goes into these kinds of operations, these kinds of attacks, you know, presumably are sorted out pretty well by now. But more than anything, the president should have been given a set of options, at least by his military planners. So there's the military side. The thing that you and I have discussed in the past, as I recall, is, and sort of the second part of this, is, you know, what happens the day after the attack? Sort of, you know, what now? Assuming that there is an attack, and I still think it's likely but not guaranteed, and I think what all administrations tend to do poorly, including the one I served in the White House with Bill Clinton, simply is coming up with good answers to that. The way you framed at the top of the hour the dilemma and sort of the different tentacles that come with this kind of decision, and presumably the military attack. What does Iran do? What does Russia do? What does Hezbollah do? What do the Syrians do? Those things, sort of the what now or what next questions, you know, presumably are being asked in the White House, and hopefully with some at least tentative answers as well. But, you know, historically, I will tell you in all candor that, you know, we are not in Washington very good at doing that. So there are a lot of uncertainties. And then, you know, even beyond that, if you sort of expand the circle of discussion, you quickly get into the broader implications for the Middle East. You know, I think there are long-term implications for how America acts in the world. You laid out some of that beautifully, our credibility as a nation. So, you know, I am also on the same horns of the dilemma you are. I do not at all think that Obama deserves any vote in Congress, but I do think the American people and the American interests do, but that's for others to decide.
I want to read an email to you and see if you agree with this email I received from Wally in Florida today, and he talks a little bit about Russia in this, and I want to ask you something about Putin after I read this email. But Wally wrote, Aaron, my concern is our small entry, as Kerry states, could easily escalate into a major conflict. I remember President Kennedy sending advisors to Vietnam that turned into a war that the U.S. was not committed to winning. We were afraid to bomb Hanoi for what China might do. We, therefore, fought with one hand behind our back and left in disgrace. I can see some parallel in Syria with going in a limited way and no plan to win, and still fearful of support from China and Russia. Seems to me we should stay out at this point in spite of embarrassment to Obama. And I guess my question to you as far as support from Russia, you know, in my opinion, and this is just me, I think Putin is nothing but a thug. And what would happen if we went in and we did attack Syria? Is he politically savvy enough not to do something crazy, or does he just not care that if we went in and went against his will, now we're fighting a war against Russia?
Well, Aaron, both your questions and the email question from Wally in Florida were very well put. I guess I have two general responses. The first is that, you know, again, generically, history, I think, teaches us that wars often come from accidents, from incidents, from inadvertent crises that no one wanted. I think of World War I as a great example, and obviously the circumstances are much different. I mean, in the Russia case, my sense is, and I love the word you use to describe Putin, by the way, because in many ways he is thuggish. The United States Navy has a large presence, certainly a substantial presence, in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Red Sea, that is far larger than what the Russians have. The Russians are sending, I think, a couple of warships, a reconnaissance ship, and things like that. I think, by and large, you know, the Russians do not in any way, in the naval sense, you know, want to get into any kind of war with this or anything like that. But again, historically, it's not my worry so much that Putin wants a battle with us, because I do not believe he does. But again, when you bring opposing forces within proximity of each other, you know, accidents happen. And I don't know any better way to say that. And again, history shows that they can. So I don't think it's something he would intentionally want to do. But I think that there's always, even if the risk is low, I think there's some possibility, you know, that we could have a problem in that sense. Now, in a broader context, Russia is heavily involved in Syria. Russians have been for decades. The Syrian chemical stockpile is really an artifact of what, you know, the cooperation it has had with Russia. If it wasn't for Russia, Syria wouldn't have chemical weapons, you know, period, end of sentence. Russia has a great strategic interest. They use the Syrian port of Tartus. That's their sort of entree in the Mediterranean, if you will. If you look at a map, actually, the Syrian border in the Russian southern city of Sochi, where the Olympics are going to be held in a few months, or actually, I guess, in a few months, they're actually only about 500 miles from each other. So Russia really sees Syria in a political context as being in its backyard. And again, I don't think that Putin is expecting hostilities, no matter what Obama does. But I think we have got to, again, look beyond the first day of any strike and think about the various things that Russia might do, even indirectly. For example, Russia has actually been very accommodating in letting the United States resupply its forces in Afghanistan, sort of through the northern transit route, as we call it, because there's been so many problems with the southern route and through Pakistan. You know, Russia could cut that off in a heartbeat. It would not be a militarily hostile act, but it would be a political hostile act, and it would be very both time-consuming, expensive, and inconvenient for us. And directly, it has nothing to do with Syria. So Russia has cards to play. And again, I think that you know, one of the problems we're sort of talking to each other back and forth is simply that when you pull on the string of an incident that may be created by a U.S. attack, you know, you start to unravel the cloth, and the, you know, the complications become, you know, the harder you pull, the more complicated it becomes. So it is a real factor. It was a good question from your Florida listener, and, you know, it is something we have got to watch very, very carefully.
One thing that concerns me in regards to Syria, and I'm going to play it for you here and for our listeners, is John Kerry said today that we are going to have an unbelievably small attack on Syria, and I have no clue. Now, I'm just a guy behind a microphone here, but I don't know why a Secretary of State would tell an enemy that we're getting ready to attack, oh, it's going to be unbelievably small. Let me play that for you real quick.
Sure.
Now, I believe that the aftermath of the Iraq experience and Afghanistan leave a lot of people saying, we don't want to, you know, see our young people coming back in a body bag and so forth. But that's not what we're talking about. And what we have to do is make clear to people that this is, we're not talking about war. We're not going to war. We will not have people at risk in that way. We will be able to hold Bashar Assad accountable without engaging in troops on the ground or any other prolonged kind of effort in a very limited, very targeted, very short-term effort that degrades his capacity to deliver chemical weapons without assuming responsibility for Syria's civil war. That is exactly what we're talking about doing. Unbelievably small, limited kind of effort.
Unbelievably small, limited kind of effort. Why would we say that to an enemy? I don't understand.
You know, it really falls short, doesn't it, Aaron? I think in a couple ways. I think one way certainly is what you said. I mean, to describe it in any sense like that really just is probably inappropriate in certainly an operational or military sense. You know, the second is, look, without playing with words here, when one nation, you know, drops bombs on another nation, and, you know, I'm sorry if the Secretary of State doesn't agree with me, but when you do that, when one nation does it to another, you're at war. There's no other way that I know as a, you know, as a political scientist to describe that. I mean, let's turn it around. If some nation lobbed 50 cruise missiles, God forbid, at any of our cities or anywhere in U.S. soil, I think most people in this country would probably say, hey, wait a minute, we've been attacked, we're at war. So, I mean, the rhetoric is, at the very least, or very best, terribly misleading. And then, obviously, look, he's trying to thread the needle in making it seem like it's something we got to do, but it's not a big deal that will get us involved. Now, you know, I'm willing to at least listen to Obama tomorrow and see how he describes this, and it'll probably be in the same fashion. But again, you know, you put one bomb on a foreign nation, you know, you've de facto you're at war, no matter what, you know, what the administration may claim. Now, they also want the American public, of course, to believe that this will be antiseptic, we'll be in and out fast, we won't lose many, if any, lives. We'll probably rely almost certainly very heavily on cruise missiles, which are, of course, as you know, unarmed. I mean, not unarmed, but unmanned. So, you know, that's all fine. But again, you know, what I think the administration has not been asked and has not had an answer for is what we discussed is, you know, after the bomb strike, after the cruise missiles presumably will hit most of their targets, you know, what does Syria do? How do they respond? Or if they use another, if they resort to another chemical weapons attack, God forbid, you know, what do we do then? And that's the pulling on the thread that the administration is really hard-pressed to answer.
You know, one thing that just befuddles me about this is when he says that, I'm sure Putin over in Russia is sitting in his chair having a good laugh. Because, I mean, like you pointed out somewhat, I mean, you know, when you drop a bomb on somebody, you are at war. It doesn't matter, you know, how big or how small the attack is, you're at war. And also today, I guess it came out, Charlie Rose had an interview with Assad. And yes. One thing, and I want to play this for you too, he said in this interview, Assad did, it's not about me, it's about the region. And what concerns me about that is he didn't say it's not about me, it's about the country. He said it's about the region. We've got Russia there, we've got Iran there, we've got, you know, other countries there. I'm going to play this for you and our listeners, and I just want to get your take on this because it scares me to death because, you know, if it's me reading between the lines, it's almost like, okay, we're going to attack Syria and we're going to face it from some other countries also. Here's the clip.
The president is prepared to strike, and perhaps we'll get the authorization of Congress or not. The question then is, would you give up chemical weapons if it would prevent the president from authorizing a strike? If that is a deal you would accept.
Again, you always imply that we have chemical weapons.
I have to, because that's the assumption of the president. Yes. That is his assumption, and he is the one who will order the strike.
It's his problem if he has an assumption. But for us in Syria, we have principles. We'd do anything to prevent the region from another crazy war. It's not only Syria, because it will start in Syria.
You'll do anything to prevent the region from having another crazy war.
Yes.
You recognize the consequences for you if there is a strike.
It's not about me. It's about the region.
It's not about me. It's about the region. Is that what he's talking about, us getting into it with other countries, not just Syria?
Well, you know, I think there's probably a couple motives. I mean, he's very clever, isn't he? I think, you know, one part of the message, of course, Aaron, is to try to deter us from attacking. I think he's probably trying to play to the, you know, the fears that, you know, justifiably many Americans have that we could be drawn into another conflict that, you know, saps us of money and the blood of our, you know, wonderful and dedicated soldiers. But there's also another message, and I think it's something, and this probably gets to the heart of your point, that can't be ignored that, you know, ever since the Arab Spring, as we call it, that really emerged in the winter of 2010-2011, you know, the region has been even more politically fragile and dysfunctional and violent than it's usually been. You know, we've of course seen it in Egypt, some of the Gulf states have had problems, Tunisia, obviously in Syria. Remember, the problems in Syria started as a domestic political unrest against Assad's brutal regime, and it has turned into this almost regional war in the sense that although Syria in a geographic sense is the battleground, there are a lot of, this not only is a political war, it has strong religious overtones, there are a lot of Sunni jihadists fighting on the side of those opposed to Assad's regime, who are Alawites, who are aligned with Shias, which is, you know, the rival sects of the Muslim faith. And it is a bloody religious conflict as well as certainly a political conflict, you know, who will ultimately govern Syria if it holds together as a nation. So, you know, we think of Syria as the nation, a lot of fighters from really around the region, again, to the opposition side, have come in from other countries, including Iraq. And then on Assad's side, fighters from Hezbollah who are backed by Iran are fighting with Assad's military forces. So, you know, it is extraordinarily complex. You almost need a Venn diagram to try to figure out all the players. But there's no doubt that there is one element of truth in what Assad says, and that's simply that although it sounds like it's one nation with a huge problem, the fact of the matter is it's one nation with a huge problem, and that problem is being fed by a number of other nations, including Iraq on one side, Iran on the other. And then, you know, on the flip side, the human tragedy of at least a couple million refugees is straining the resources in Turkey and in Jordan. I mean, this problem almost has no end in sight unless something changes the dynamics. And we will see if the Obama actions do or don't bring that about, no matter, you know, what he may tell the American people tomorrow night. So aside from that, it's pretty simple, huh?
Yeah, well, very simple, sounds like. Geez. one thing I have to ask you, too, is, you know, Rush Limbaugh, on his past two or three shows, has mentioned this, and I want to get your take on it. And he has said that he has good sources, and granted, it's Rush Limbaugh, and he's on the radio, too, but he has good sources that question whether or not it was actually the Syrian government that did these chemical attacks, that Assad may be set up. I mean, could it be that the rebels gassed their own people just to get Assad thrown out?
Yeah, well, you know, Rush runs a marvelously good program that I get to listen to from time to time, and he's always interesting, always provocative. I think, Aaron, in this case, the preponderance of evidence, overwhelming, is that it's from the Assad government. You know, let me tell you why. First of all, it's the Assad government, you know, that has the access to the chemical munitions. To my knowledge, the opposition forces do not. Most of the, in most cases, and these are very large stockpiles, in almost all cases, nations with any kind of weapon of mass destruction, whether we like the regime or not, you know, pay a great deal of time and resources to secure them for obvious reasons. That they don't want those kinds of weapons out of their control. In addition to that, we've seen some of the weapons, some of the small missiles that were used. Are missiles really controlled by the Assad regime as well? And as you said, the victims of the attack were in part of Damascus, a Damascus suburb that is controlled by the opposition. The idea that the opposition would do this is, you know, to gas its own people, as you say, is, I would not say it's impossible, but I think it would be so heinous and so barbaric that I certainly hope that's just a remote possibility. There's also apparently some intelligence that the Obama administration has referred to that talks about a Syrian commander at a senior level communicating with a sort of a field operative and, you know, sort of horrified by what had happened. So, I would not say it's impossible, but I think, you know, the most likely explanation by far is that the Assad government was responsible for this.
We're approaching the half hour, but we're going to hold off on news. We're going to continue our conversation with Jack Caravelli. Give us a call, 646-200-3400. Jack, I do have a caller from Virginia, Steve from Virginia. He has a question on the international community monitoring the chemical weapons that Syria may have. Steve from Virginia, welcome to the show.
No, thank you. My question was regarding comments that John Kerry had made today, and it seemed like that his remarks afterwards that it was just an off-the-cuff comment about a question. Someone asked him what would stop this, and he said, turn over the chemical weapons to international inspectors. Again, later said that was just pretty much an off-the-cuff comment, not one to be suggesting that be the policy. But then Russia, I think, took him up on it. And then Hillary even alluded to it in some comments that she made, that talking about Kerry's idea. So I'm wondering what your thoughts were on that. And then also if there's time, seemed like the 180 that Obama's done on the red line. That he drew the red line and now said he didn't make the line, someone else did earlier.
Yeah, that's great. I guess he erased the red line, huh? Well, thank you for the questions. On the international sort of inspections or control, you know, the Russians, again, were very clever, as I think you know. I think it's probably, I guess, what the diplomats would call a dead letter, almost certainly something that Assad would not agree to. You know, as he said to Charlie Rose, he's not even sure that he or doesn't even acknowledge that they have them. So how can you give up something you don't have? But I think even beyond the rhetoric, you know, again, these are very large stockpiles, one of the largest stockpiles in the world of chemical weapons. I don't think you give them up. They're scattered around the country. And I think to do something that was truly credible and quick is an extraordinary reach. Is it possible? Yeah, probably is. Is it likely? I think in any realistic sense, no. The Russians obviously know that by sort of jumping on that bandwagon, you know, they would attempt to sort of complicate things and make it seem like Obama might be unreasonable. But I think, frankly, and I don't mean to trivialize this, the ball is truly in Assad's court, and without the clearest, you know, with no conditions offered to do something like that, you know, immediately, if I'm Obama, I've got to take this as just a delaying tactic and move forward. I'm sorry, you had a second question?
He was actually, thanks for the call, Steve, but he was actually asking about Obama's 180 with the red line.
Oh, yeah, the red line, yes. I think, Aaron, look, we are all paying the price, in a sense, for Obama's poor use of words. You know, if you're a president of the United States, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, and you're going to use words to the world like red line, you got to be awfully clear about what you mean, what constitutes crossing the red line, because Obama's original statement was very vague if you look at it closely, and then you've got to be prepared to back it up. And, you know, I think those words may come back to haunt all of this, but it was the product of, again, a lack of policy focus, as we were, you know, discussing at the top of the show. But now we're sort of stuck with this phrase that will, I think books will be written about this, in this incident of Syria, probably by scholars for years to come, for all the things it tells us about sort of good and bad policy making in the White House. And, you know, the phrase red line was extraordinarily unhelpful, but now we're all stuck with the dilemma you laid out, Aaron, at the start of, you know, do we, you know, maintain our credibility by doing something, or do we look the fools? And by looking the fools, as actually some Republicans have argued, including Stephen Hadley today in the Washington Post, who was George Bush's national security advisor. Hadley made, you know, answered the question you posed, Aaron, at the start, and Hadley's answer is, the credibility of the United States, no matter who is the president, is of such important magnitude that he, Hadley, you know, would support, you know, military intervention. Maybe not the exact way that Obama would, but it's interesting that some of the Republicans, including Hadley, as I mentioned, but also the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, the Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, all Republicans are saying that, you know, they sort of get it, and they will support the administration on this. So this will be a very important speech tomorrow night, and of course I hope much of your audience will get a chance to listen to it.
Well, I hope so too. And, you know, one thing, and I was listening to the radio here in Atlanta, where we're based out of, and Eric Erickson was on the radio, and he brought up a very good point, and I think this, to me anyway, sums up really the core of the problem and the reason we're in the situation that we're in is, you know, he said A people hire A people. For example, George W. Bush, whether you liked him, hated him, he surrounded himself with very, very good people, very smart people. And Bill Clinton did the exact same thing, surrounded himself with very good people, very smart people, and you know, in some cases, you know, and sometimes in most cases, smarter than, you know, the both of them. But then he also said that B people hire C and D people because they want to feel like that they want people to see that they feel like the person that hired them, the boss, knows everything, and so he hires people that aren't as smart as him. And, you know, I look at this administration, and I think it just boils down to Obama's decision-making and the people that he's surrounded himself with. I don't know if he's really, you know, arrogant and not accepting advice, or if he has hired people that he feels aren't as smart as him, and then they're giving him all this advice, and he's taking it. I mean, just like John Kerry, in my opinion, John Kerry isn't as smart as he thinks he is, just for his unbelievably small comment. But, I mean, could that be the problem? I mean, you were in the Clinton administration around, you know, you yourself are a very smart person, around very smart people there. In the Bush administration, he had very smart people. But I just don't see as much intelligence in the Obama administration.
Well, Aaron, sadly, I agree with you. I had the privilege of serving with some very good and dedicated people for Clinton. I was not a political appointee. As you know, I was a senior career-serving officer and served the president in the White House. My great concern, and it's been evident since the first days that Barack Obama became president, number one, looking at the president himself, very inexperienced in foreign policy. He'd only been a senator for about 2 years, which is really nothing. He had been a community organizer, a constitutional lawyer, a professor, and that's all great stuff. But you know, when it comes to being able to deal with the world, he has been overmatched and sadly over his head. He is not exactly, as you've said, he has not surrounded himself in most cases with a good, you know, sort of deep bench, a strong group of policy advisors. I think Obama, remember early on, was given the Nobel Peace Prize, which was extraordinarily premature and probably undeserved, but it was what it was. But I think early on, Obama thought he could, by virtue of logic and reason, convince the world, you know, to join hands and move forward. But the fact of the matter is that although, you know, we sometimes talk of an international community, you know, it's really not. It's a world of nation states with their own interests, with their own pursuits, you know, with their own views of the world. And Obama has been, I think, a singular failure in being able to bring about any marked improvement. And I think the real sad part, Aaron, if you look across the political landscape internationally, both with our adversaries and our friends, our relations are in almost every case worse off than they were at the start of the Obama presidency. You know, it's not like, you know, we're doing great things with the Israelis or the British or the French, and so it's okay that we're still having problems with Iran or Syria or Russia. Across the board, this president has been singularly unable or unwilling to find a path forward that's advanced, you know, the U.S. national interest. And I think his hard sell tomorrow night is really going to be based on that, convincing the American public that, given his very poor track record, that he's got some kind of great new compelling reason to advance the national interest through these, as John Kerry said, these very limited strikes. And I think for good reason the American public should all be from Missouri, from the Show Me State, as they listen to this. And I think he has an uphill battle, in large measure, because he has been one of the worst foreign policy presidents since World War II. And that's, again, we're all paying the price for that.
Caller from Illinois, he doesn't want to go on the air, but Adam is telling me in my ear here he does have a question, and he wants to know what you think we should do and what is going on that we really don't know about.
Well, on the first part, I thank him for the question. I think that let me go back again a step. We all of us soon may pay the price for bad policy. And in this sense, and to begin to respond to the question from Illinois, I mean that, you know, 2 years ago, the president's advisors, very briefly General Petraeus at CIA, and then Hillary Clinton, who was an exception probably to my the rule that I thought they were very bad, the advisors, the administration, the two of them particularly, I think very forcefully 2 years ago, urged Obama to take some course of actions that could have, made this conversation tonight moot, that it would have never happened because we would have engaged in a different way. Now, okay, we can't turn the clock back. What can we do? With great reluctance to give a specific answer to the question, I would begin a much more sustained campaign to really weaken the Assad regime. I would not in any way put the boots on the ground. I would make it clear that the status quo is in no one's interest, in the region or in our interest. I would make it clear that we would begin to significantly arm the rebels. I am very aware that there is an argument that we may be arming some jihadists. I think there are ways that we have not looked at very creatively to at least mitigate the possibility that that would happen. I think anyone that claims that they know the percentage of the real bad actors who are supporting the opposition against Assad, I've heard numbers of 20%, 50%. The short answer, Aaron, is no one knows. But I think there are ways to identify and work with the groups who are truly, hopefully in the majority, that want a better day, a stable day, just peace for Syria. If we can find them, support them, you know, and it won't be simple. With some reluctance, I would say I would back the strike, but I would widen it, put no boots on the ground, but then begin a strong series of actions, again, with money and armaments that would help the opposition, again, if there's such a thing as good opposition, to advance the claims. And if I think you've got to have a metric of a timeline. This couldn't be an open-ended commitment. I think you have to, if you did those things, you assess it after 3 months or 6 months, and if you do your best and you still can't topple them, then I think then they're going to have to figure it out themselves.
One concern I have, and nobody wants boots on the ground, but let's say that we are attacking Syria and we've got cruise missiles, but let's say we send in fighter jets in, and God forbid one of those jets gets shot down, and we send a reconnaissance team in to recover our downed pilot. If the worst case scenario happens and our reconnaissance team's attacked, I mean, we don't have a choice, do we? I mean, even though this is just going to be, you know, an aerial attack of cruise missiles or maybe fighters, I mean, there's still a real chance that we may have boots on the ground and we may be involved just because of this into a full-blown conflict.
Aaron, you are absolutely right. You know, I had this conversation with a most respected friend of mine who was a really a war hero, who commanded troops in in Vietnam, was a flag rank officer at the end of his career, a two-star general. And, you know, the great point he made to me is the one you're making, that, look, you know, when you use the phrase war plan, you know, things never go according to plan. There are always risks. You know, war is never neat, as he told me. And, you know, he makes a very compelling point that we are in a very dangerous situation. There, you know, if Obama at all implies tomorrow that, you know, this is neat, surgical, or clean, you know, well, you know, okay, that's the plan. But look, when you're at war, you know, the plans quickly go out the window, and we have to be aware of that. We have to be prepared to accept that. Or if we're not, then we do nothing, and, you know, we let the chips fall where they may. But your scenario is probably one of a dozen that you or I or your listeners, you know, could weigh in with, and I would shake my head and say, yes, they're probably all reasonably valid. And again, that's the hell of all of this, that, you know, the best of intentions aren't necessarily the way things turn out.
One concern I have, too, and I would like you to weigh in on it. You know, some people say that Iraq, when we were heavily involved in Iraq, and we all the intelligence reports said that they had chemical weapons, and then we went in and couldn't find any. Some people thought that they went to Syria. What's to say we go in to Syria looking for these weapons, or these international inspectors go in looking for these weapons? I mean, because, my goodness, we've given them time enough to do something with these. Right. What's the possibility there's nothing there? And, you know, since Russia's in cahoots with Syria, could these chemical weapons now be in Russia?
The short answer is that scenario is certainly plausible. You know, we certainly, let's say if we were winding the clock back 6 months or a year, you know, we could readily identify, you know, through various means of intelligence, surveillance, you know, the locations of those kind of facilities, you know, with great deal of confidence. I never, having been an intelligence officer, I never want to say that anything is perfect, but I think we would have very high confidence in, you know, 6 months ago and understanding where those were. The great unknown is what you say. We, you know, the great phrase that you never know what you don't know. And in this case, you know, there are certainly scenarios that I could imagine that where weapons were certainly moved, were hidden. I think we knew that, you know, as we were trying to figure out, for example, what Iraq was doing before the war, before the 2003 war, the inspectors and the, you know, there was a great deal of effort on Hussein's part to move nuclear weapons associated facilities. The same thing we saw actually in Libya. I think one of the great failings of this administration, and I advised the State Department on this and others did as well, that when it really, again, when the Arab Spring arose and Gaddafi was in such political troubles, there were large numbers of conventional arms, munitions and depots. And, you know, the State Department was advised to, you know, if you're going to do anything, you know, secure those weapons. And they did not. Actually, the State Department lied about it. They said they had a team, I remember this vividly, a team in country that was going to secure it. What it actually was, I think, five people who were already in country on another mission. So the State Department was not at all truthful to the American public, and the result of the chaos in Libya was that probably thousands of conventional arms got out of the country, and my guess is that probably a fair number of them, you know, somehow wound up in the hands of jihadist terrorists. So it was another policy failure. So, you know, given those two examples I cited, Iraq and Libya, the scenario that you sketch out, you know, I think is highly plausible. In fact, I would expect Assad to be doing some of that if he hasn't already. I am not aware of any evidence that he has. But again, you know, we're back to this. You know, we keep coming back to the conversation of, you know, we devise a plan. We think it's wonderful and perfect, but then, you know, we don't look or we don't know what the other side of that coin, the recipient of the plan, you know, they've got their own options to play from. And the one you laid out, I think, is frankly, is something I would be expecting Assad to do. You know, now maybe we're monitoring all this with our different assets. I hope we are. But again, you know, when we're really sure of something, Aaron, we're either going to be really, really right or really, really wrong.
One last question I have for you, and you've been great to stay on as long as you have, is we've heard from Obama, we've heard from John Kerry, but you're in Washington, D.C. Have you seen Chuck Hagel, our Secretary of Defense? I have not heard from him. You know, we're on the brink of possibly going to war, and where is our Secretary of Defense?
Well, I think, Aaron, he has been at some of the hearings. He and General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I saw a couple of C-SPAN programs where they were the three of them, Kerry, Hagel, and Dempsey, were testifying together. I think in the two that come to mind that I saw, you know, 90% of this was of the administration argument, if you will, was carried by Kerry, I think, as you imply. He has by far, for whatever reason, been the most vocal, the most passionate about this. And when you just look at the body language of both Secretary Hagel, who I've met and know a little bit, when you look at General Dempsey, the two of them almost, Aaron, look like they would rather be anywhere than sitting in front of the Congress and the cameras trying to defend this. And it is a difficult thing to watch as a, you know, as a Washingtonian, you know, that, you know, clearly the team, if you will, around the president have, I think, at best mixed feelings on this. And that does not bode well for the long term. And it goes back to your question about having some people around him, that around the president, that perhaps are either not up to the job or alternatively just don't share his views. And, you know, either one of those outcomes, again, does not serve any of us very well.
Well, Jack, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate your insight. And as we continue on with Syria, and, you know, one thing is certain, only time will tell what exactly happens. You are welcome to come back anytime, talk about Syria. I'm sure we have a lot more going on to talk about. And as with you tomorrow night, I'm going to anxiously wait to see what Obama says, and hopefully he can put a country at ease.
Yeah, Aaron, that would be great if he could. Again, it's a hard sigh. I thank you very much for the time, and certainly to your listeners for their questions. And maybe we can cycle back on this next week and update things and just share some thoughts. And again, I thank you, and have to congratulate you before I leave on the show, that I know just continues to go and do great guns, and your willingness to, you know, devote this kind of time to me or anyone on one topic is just refreshing, because as you well know, when you get on television, most of the shows are 30 or 60 second sound bites that really do nothing but shed a lot more heat and light on the issues. And if nothing else, the chance to just sort of kick the issues around with you for this length of time, I hope, serves your listeners very well. And I hope they appreciate that you are willing to devote the time, whether it's me or obviously many other guests, to, you know, to try and to do it the right way. So, you know, thank you and congratulations.
Well, I appreciate that. And hopefully we will talk to you next week.
Thanks very much, Aaron. Have a good night.
You too. Thank you, Jack.
Right, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Jack Caravelli, and as you heard, he has extraordinary insight and brings a whole new perspective to the show. on what we can expect in Syria, what's going on behind the scenes, what to expect. And this is, you know, I started out the show at the top of the hour saying that we would figure this out together and maybe we could figure out if we were going to support going into Syria or if we need to just stay at home. And, you know, the more you dive into it, the more complicated it gets. And I am no fan of Barack Obama. We all know that. But I do not envy his job right now or anybody in Washington. And the only thing that we can do is, you know, not to get religious on everybody, but hope and pray that our leaders of this country, whether we disagree with them or not, make the right decisions for this country. We're going to go to news, and then I'm going to have some final comments as soon as we return from the news. Thanks for joining us, and again, thanks to Jack Caravelli.
Fox News Radio, I'm Jane Metzler, acknowledging the American public is skeptical and supporting Congress fading for U.S. military intervention in Syria. President Obama telling Fox's Chris Wallace he's reviewing Russia's proposal to put Syria's chemical stockpile under international control.
I think we should explore and exhaust all avenues of diplomatic resolution of this. But I think it's important for us to keep the pressure on and to quote, or to paraphrase at least, former U.S. President, Ronald Reagan, it's not enough just to trust. I think we're going to have to verify.
The president addresses the nation tomorrow at 9 p.m. Eastern. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, meantime, putting off a procedural vote on that resolution authorizing a U.S. military strike with a filibuster threatened. Chris Wallace noting,
better to put this thing off for a little while there's some diplomacy and some continued debate, than to push ahead with a vote that he was going to lose.
Senator Reid saying he doesn't want to rush this and wants to do it right. The latest Fox News poll finding most Americans think the idea of a military strike against Syria is wrong. 60% do not approve, 29% do, 11% aren't sure how they feel about it. Investors encouraged by Russia's proposal to put Syria's chemical weapons under international control. The Dow up 141, the Nasdaq gains 46. A concern for investors, a possible government shutdown next month.
House Republicans are expected to huddle tomorrow, trying to draft a continuing resolution, a spending bill to keep the government from shutting down October 1st. Many conservatives are urging leadership to defund the Affordable Care Act as part of that proposal.
Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern, and you're listening to Fox News Radio, Fair and Balanced.
Fox News Early Prime, breaking down business news and its impact on your bottom line. Your World with Neil Cavuto.
That's how I do business. That's why I am this.
Bold positions and brash opinions on the topics America is buzzing about. The Five.
How do you think this will set in with the American people?
This will be the pulse of the nation.
Washington insight and political know-how from the best in the Beltway. Special report with Brett Baer.
The epicenter of the political world is here.
The number one place for fair and balanced coverage. Fox News Channel.
What's wrong with working hard to make our lives and our kids' lives better? Nothing. At Fox Business, we don't have a problem with success. We have a very big problem with those who get in the way of it. We don't come out of the box bashing those who make money, just the politicians stealing it and the bureaucracy wasting it. We're not just sitting behind a desk. We're out in the field, on the floor, with the folks. Because when a story moves forward, so do we.
Fox Business, the power to prosper. Check your local listings.
Acquitted of murdering teen Trayvon Martin, now a domestic dispute involving George Zimmerman and his estranged wife.
Just days after filing for divorce.
I don't know what he's capable of. I'm really scared.
Shelley Zimmerman calls 911, claiming George Zimmerman punched her father.
And then took my iPad out of my hand and smashed it and cut it with a pocket knife.
And she tells the dispatcher, threatened to shoot them from inside his truck.
And he continually has his hand on his gun and he keeps saying, closer.
But George Zimmerman claims he wasn't the aggressor, and his attorney, Mark O'Mara, says his gun was kept holstered and under his shirt the whole time. This after other recent incidents, including a speeding ticket.
Anything that he does is going to be hyper-focused upon and scrutinized.
O'Mara says the Zimmermans should stay away from each other and let the attorneys handle the divorce. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Neither Shelley Zimmerman nor her father want to press charges. A trustee for the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, meantime, wants to honor the memory of Trayvon Martin by naming an asteroid after the teen. Scientists at the observatory discovered hundreds of asteroids in the year 2000. Tomorrow, Apple expected to unveil not one, but two new iPhones.
The iPhone 5S is expected to be able to identify its owner by fingerprint and have a better rear-facing camera. But Eric Slivcutt, MacRumors.com, notes there's also talk of a cheaper iPhone, the iPhone 5C.
The plastic shell would be a little bit cheaper to make for Apple, and then also reusing the hardware from the iPhone 5 is going to allow Apple to bring down some of its costs.
When these new phones come out, Apple is also expected to make iOS 7 available too, which Slivcutt says will dramatically change the look of the operating system.
Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal. The men's final of the U.S. Open now underway at Flushing Meadows. Number 2 seed Rafael Nadal now leads number 1 seed Novak Djokovic 2-1 in the fourth set. I'm Jay Metzler, Fox News Radio.
A colorless landscape. The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One voter at a time. This is Aaron McGrady.
Well, I am back, and actually, we're getting ready to end the show. Our time is up for today. We went long with Jack Caravelli, but again, it is extremely important we all are engaged and aware with Syria. We are off tomorrow. Tomorrow's the presidential address at 9 o'clock. I want all of you that's listening to make sure we have, knowledge of what our leaders say. So that's tomorrow night at 9 o'clock p.m. You'll see it on just about every network, so you'll be able to find it. You'll be listening to Barack Obama. And then also, we're going to have a show on Thursday, but we're not having one on 9/11, just because we need to keep those men and women in our thoughts and our prayers. Those family members went through extraordinary losses back on September 11th, 2001. And also on September 11th, 2012, with the Benghazi attacks. But join me back here on Thursday at 9 p.m. Make sure that you give us a call at 646-200-3400 on Thursday. And have a great night. And make sure you listen to Obama tomorrow at 9.